This podcast contains graphic content and crimes against children that may not be suitable for some listeners. Listener discretion is advised. I want to remind our listeners you can view all episodes and transcripts, purchase merchandise, and support our show by visiting our website. Your support is what keeps this show going, and any and all support is greatly appreciated.
Last April 13th, the little resort and railroad town of Keddie in remote Plumas County hit the headlines. The county awoke with horror that Monday morning. There had been committed there a crime so bizarre it should have happened in the big city. Indeed, it was the reason most Keddie residents had moved to the country to escape crime.
Cases that take place in cabins or around cabins always have an extra eeriness to them, don't they? There's something about a crime being committed around or in the woods that's a bit unnerving. On my podcast, I covered a case known as the Oklahoma Girl Scout Murders. That case will definitely give you chills, and my recommendation is don't listen to it at night, in a cabin, or in the woods. That case, like this one, is unsolved. And I hate unsolved cases. Not just because it's frustrating not to have closure at the end of listening to a case, but because in many cold cases, there seems to be an enormous amount of evidence just sitting there waiting to point to someone. Look at the JonBenet Ramsey case. That seemed like an open and shut case. So much evidence, a closed off crime scene, a bizarre multi-page ransom letter, and yet nothing. No suspects. With all the advancements being made in DNA testing and familial DNA, I think we're going to see a lot more cases being solved over the next several years. On the downside of that is that we know DNA doesn't last indefinitely, so there's a ticking clock on those cases for sure. The story for this episode takes place in Keddie, California. If you've never heard of Keddie, don't feel bad. Neither had I before this case. Keddie is a tiny community in the Plumas National Forest with a population of less than 100 people and is about 240 miles northeast of San Francisco. In Keddie is a town within a town called the Keddie Resort, and I use the term resort lightly. It is in fact not a glamorous resort by any stretch of the imagination, but was founded back in 1910 and was a peaceful getaway where you can rent one of 33 rustic cabins or a room in the resort's two-story lodge. There's a small stream nearby where you can fish, and there are several trails in the area to explore. If you pull up Keddie on a map, you will quickly see how isolated and remote the area is. It's so isolated that you can't even drop the little Google Map yellow guy anywhere close to the location. The main lodge had a restaurant that was packed mostly every night with customers who came from as far as San Francisco to dine on barbecued bear ribs, sherry-basted raccoon steaks, all locally hunted, and fine wines. It was the summer of 1979, and 34-year-old Glenna Sue Sharp was struggling in a tumultuous relationship with her husband James when she made the decision to separate from him and leave Connecticut and head west with her five children to Northern California, where her brother Don lived at the time. Not having much money, she rented a small one-bedroom trailer that her brother and his wife had recently lived in at the Claremont Trailer Village in Quincy, California. Quincy was another small mountain town with a population of about 1,800 people and was about 5 miles south of Keddie, and was home to the Plumas Sierra County Fair. Here's Sue's sister, Jackie Holbert, talking about her sister Sue's situation.
Because she had no place else to go. She had been living here for quite a while, well, over a year. And then her husband decided he wanted her back. So foolish enough, she packed up and went back to him. And within 6 months, she was kicked out of the house again. So she went to live with my brother in Quincy.
After living in Quincy for just a little over a year, Sue had heard there was a small mountain town nearby. With her large family being cramped in the smaller trailer, Sue uprooted again and took her children, 15-year-old John, 14-year-old Sheila, 12-year-old Tina, 10-year-old Rick, and 5-year-old Greg, and moved into the resort town of Keddy and into house number 28, a modest, rundown, 4-room cabin that was much smaller than the trailer they'd lived in, but had become available when Plumas County Sheriff Sylvester Douglas Thomas had moved out. The Keddy cabins were once a successful resort destination, but by the 1980s, the cabins had gone into a state of disrepair and were being rented out to low-income families. The resort community had become a safe haven for these families, and Keddy was considered a safe community, one where residents didn't feel the need to lock their doors. Several years later, Sheila would recall the moment her family moved into the cabin.
November 1980 is when we moved into Keddy in a small cabin, which was number 28. Rick Gregg slept in one room. My mom, Tina, and I slept in another room. And Johnny, there was a basement downstairs, and he, since he was the oldest, he got to sleep down there.
The family got settled into their new home. John would make his room in the unfinished basement. Rick and Greg bunked together in a bedroom. And Sue shared a room with her daughters, Sheila and Tina. They began making new friends at school and got to know the other families at the Keddy Resort. Sue was enrolled in a federal education program that gave her a small amount of money to attend business classes at the local community college. She was a good student, got good grades, and was liked by her classmates, but they said she preferred to study alone and wouldn't join them on coffee breaks. Sue wasn't working a job at the time, and she was surviving off of the $250 she received from her ex-husband each month, and she'd use food stamps and welfare for groceries. She was looked down upon by the other residents at the resort because she was on welfare, and she seemed to date a lot of men. The locals would spread rumors and gossip about her dealing in drugs or sleeping with men for money. Because she kept to herself and didn't reach out to make a lot of friends, the residents were left to come up with their own assumptions about her.
The mother was the type who had a lot of men friends, constant comings and goings, as I understand it. You know, everyone knew that the family was on welfare, and in those days that was not a popular thing to have happen to you here in Plumas County, and so you immediately had sort of a stigmatism attached to you. You know, there were a lot of rumors at the time about, you know, my gosh, the way she deals drugs, it could be anybody. You know, it could have been a big drug party that got out of hand. Some of the rumors dealt with her sleeping with various men for money.
Neighbors Anita Seabolt and her husband James lived next door to the Sharps and didn't particularly feel comfortable about Sue.
I didn't feel any better about Sue then because I just felt like I was very judgmental and thought she should have been a better mother. And I wouldn't let my kids go over there, but I was welcomed her kids over to our house and wanted them to be there and be safe. But the night it happened, they wanted Paula to stay the night, and I wouldn't let her stay. And I just felt like my kids didn't belong over there.
All of this didn't seem to bother Sue, as she focused on her education and her family and looked forward to hopefully one day owning a small business and buying a house large enough for her kids to keep them safe. On Saturday, April 11, 1981, around 11:30 in the morning, Sue, Sheila, and Greg drove from a friend's house, the Meeks family, to pick up Rick, who was at baseball tryouts at Gansner Field in Quincy. On their way back home, they spotted John and his high school friend, 17-year-old Dana Wingate, hitchhiking from Quincy. Sue picked them up, and they all headed home. A couple of hours later, around 3:30, John and Dana hitchhiked back to Quincy, where they planned to visit some friends at a party, and were seen in the city's downtown area. Rick and Greg rode bikes with their friend and neighbor, 12-year-old Justin Eason, most of the afternoon until it got dark, then they went home. Justin had planned to stay the night for a sleepover at the Sharps' house. Sheila planned to stay the night at her friend's house, the Seabolt family, who lived in nearby cabin number 27, and left a little after 8 p.m. to head over there. Tina, who'd also been watching TV with the Seabolts, left their house at around 9:30 p.m. and headed back to her own house. Sue had no plans on going out that evening, but stayed in with Rick, Greg, Justin, and Tina, and waited for John and Dana to come home later that night. Greg was the first to head to bed at around 11:30, followed by Tina around 9:30. Rick and Justin watched the Love Boat with Sue before the boys headed to bed around 10 p.m. Sue stayed up on the sofa and watched some more TV. The next morning between 7:30 and 8 o'clock, Sheila woke up early to head back home so she could change into some nicer clothes to attend church with the Seabolts that morning. But when she walked into her house, she found the most disturbing and gruesome scene she'd ever seen. Someone was lying on the floor next to the living room couch, their upper body and face covered with a blanket, their ankles tied with some sort of cord. Her brother John was lying on the floor in the living room, and another boy was lying next to him. Their ankles also had some sort of tie around them, and blood was everywhere throughout the small living room. Sheila ran screaming back to the neighbor's house. She told the Seabolts what she saw, and they ran over to the main lodge to tell them to call 911, as the Seabolts didn't have a telephone. At 8:05 a.m., the sheriff's dispatch received a call from Jan Albin, co-owner of the Keddie Resort. She reported a possible homicide in cabin 28. While dispatch was being notified, Sheila's friend's dad, James Seabolt, ran back to cabin 28, where they tapped on the bedroom where Rick, Greg, and Justin were sleeping. They woke them up and helped them out through a bedroom window to avoid them seeing the horrific scene in the living room. Once the boys were outside, Sheila sent Justin home to his parents, and James went back to the house to see if anyone inside was alive. He entered the cabin through the unlocked back door and walked through the house, possibly contaminating the crime scene, calling out for anyone, but got no answer. He left and waited for police to arrive. Between 8:30 and 9:30, police began to arrive at the scene. Deputy Hank Clement was the first to arrive. In the cabin, he found the three bodies. It appeared two boys were lying on the living room floor, and there was a substantial amount of blood around their heads and necks. Another body was lying next to the sofa and had a blanket partially draped over the body, revealing their legs and feet. One of the boys, who was later identified as John, was closest to the front door. His hands and ankles had been bound with electrical cord and medical tape, and he was fully clothed. They found a steak knife that had been bent roughly 30 degrees near John's body, and found a butcher knife and claw hammer, also covered in blood, placed side by side on a small wooden table near the entry into the kitchen. Beside John was another boy who was later identified as Dana. He was lying face down and his feet were also bound with an electrical cord, which was connected to John's feet. He was laying on his right arm with his left arm to his side. His head was partially propped on a sofa cushion on the floor, and he was fully clothed. The deputy lifted the blanket off the body next to the sofa and saw that it was a woman. She was wearing some type of long terry cloth shirt or dress that was pulled up around her abdomen, and she was naked from the waist down. Her hands had been bound in front of her with electrical wire that was connected to her ankles, and they were also bound. She had blood around her head and neck. She was lying slightly on her side, face up, and had women's underwear stuffed in her mouth and had a blue bandana over the underwear, which was secured to her face with medical tape. Clement checked the bodies for pulses, but they were all deceased. He noted in his report that he saw blood everywhere, on the walls, the bottoms of the victim's shoes, on the woman's bare feet, on bedding in one of the rooms, on the furniture, on the ceiling, on the doors, and on the back steps. Next on the scene was Sergeant Jerry Shaver, who took witness statements outside the home. Shaver and Clement then went into the cabin and walked through each room. Plumas County Sheriff Sylvester Doug Thomas and Assistant Sheriff Ken Shanks arrived, along with Deputy Lieutenant John Stoy. The five men then proceeded to walk again through the cabin without securing the crime scene, possibly destroying and contaminating evidence in the process, looking for additional victims or suspects. Once the house was cleared, they began documenting for evidence and taking photos of the scene. It would take the police several hours to discover that a fourth victim, 12-year-old Tina Sharp, was missing. Tina's jacket, shoes, and a toolbox containing various tools was also missing from the house. Once it was discovered she was missing, the FBI got involved in the investigation, but they only stayed involved for 2 weeks before handing the investigation back over to the Plumas County Sheriff's Office. Autopsies were conducted on each victim. At the time of the murders, Sue was wearing a green or blue terry cloth, muumuu-type lounge dress, and a white bra. The dress had been pulled up to her abdomen and was partially soaked in blood. A pair of women's underwear and a blue bandana were embedded deep in her mouth and secured to her face with medical tape. She had 3-inch bruising on the left side of her face and multiple lacerations to the left and right side of her head and face. She'd been stabbed in the chest 4 times and sustained a horizontal stab wound to her throat, the wound going through her larynx and nicking her spine. On the side of her head, right below her right ear, was an imprint that investigators would later discover to be a match to the butt of a Daisy 880 Powerline BB pellet rifle. She had defensive wounds on her hands, and her cause of death was her multiple injuries. John was wearing a blue zip-up sweatshirt with a white tank top underneath it and a sleeveless blue ski vest over that. He had on sweatpants with red athletic shorts underneath and underwear. He had bruising to both eyes and 2 stab wounds to his chest. He had lacerations above and near his eyes, along with significant bruising to his eyes, and multiple lacerations to the right and left side of his head, and had about a 2.25-inch slit on his throat. John's cause of death was from the stab wounds. Dana was wearing Levi corduroy jeans with a sweater and an orange t-shirt underneath, and brown hiking boots. He had multiple fractured and loosened teeth and multiple lacerations to his head. He'd been manually strangled to death. Dana's cause of death was cranial cerebral trauma and strangulation. Both boys had suffered blunt force trauma to their heads caused by a hammer or hammers. The Seabolt family, Sheila, and the residents of Keddie Resort were all interviewed, and none of them stated they heard any commotion or sounds coming from Cabin 28 that night. A few residents recalled seeing a green van parked at the Sharp's house around 9 p.m. A woman and her boyfriend, who lived in nearby house number 16, said that they were woken up at 1:15 a.m. by what sounded like muffled screaming. They couldn't figure out where the sounds were coming from, so they went back to sleep. The Sharp's landline telephone had been taken off the hook, and the cord was cut from the outlet. The drapes inside the home were closed, and the lights had been shut off. There was no forced entry into the home, but an unidentified bloody fingerprint was pulled from a handrail that led to the cabin's back door, and another fingerprint was inside of a door frame. There was a bloody footprint in the yard, drops of blood on Tina's bed cover, and knife marks on various walls throughout the home. There was no drug paraphernalia or illegal drugs found in the home, dismissing rumors that the murders were drug or ritual related. The lack of fingerprints at the scene indicated to investigators that the perpetrators wore gloves and were prepared. This was the early 80s, so forensic evidence wasn't collected. That includes no hair and no skin cells. And DNA wasn't a thing yet. That didn't come into play until years later. All of the blood at the scene was determined to belong to the victims. They also believe that more than one individual was involved and that the victims were moved and repositioned as there were pools of blood on the floor, not near any of the bodies. The blood on the bottom of Sue's feet and on one of the boys' shoes indicated that they were mobile and walking around in the blood at some point during the attack. The weapons that were found at the scene were a steak knife, a butcher knife, a bloody hammer, and a pellet gun. Additional evidence, including a second bloody knife, turned up in a trash bin behind the Keddie store. Sheila told investigators that the family never had medical tape in their house before, so it was believed that the suspects must have brought the tape with them. Rick, Greg, and Justin were interviewed by detectives. What's interesting is that with the exception of one of the boys, they seem to have been unaware of what happened in the house and slept through the entire assault. Justin was the only boy that had recollected anything, and initially he claimed that he'd dreamt of the murders. Because of his sketchy recollections of that night, he was put under hypnosis. Under hypnosis, he claimed that while sleeping in the room with Rick and Greg, he woke up to sounds coming from the living room. He got up and walked to the bedroom door, where he saw Sue in the living room with two men. One of them had a mustache and short hair, and the other was clean-shaven with long hair, and both men wore sunglasses. He said that John and Dana then came into the house and started arguing with the two men. They got into a fight, and Tina came into the living room and was taken out of the cabin's back door by one of the men. They attempted hypnosis on Greg as well, but because he was only 5 years old, he was too hyperactive to hypnotize. Based on Justin's description of the men, composite sketches were drawn up by Harlan Embry, an amateur artist who had apparently been a volunteer with the police department. He basically had no artistic ability and no training in forensic sketching. Why in the world this person was brought on to do the sketches on such a critical murder case is beyond me and remains a mystery, as the police did have access to the Justice Department's and the Federal Bureau of Investigation's top forensic artists. In press releases that displayed the sketches, the suspects were described as being in their late 20s to early 30s. One stood between 5 feet 11 inches to 6 feet 2 inches tall and had dark blonde hair. And the other was between 5 feet 6 inches and 5 feet 10 inches tall with black greased hair. Both of the men wore gold-framed sunglasses. As the search for Tina continued, investigators and the FBI viewed it as an abduction, but the FBI eventually backed off the case and allowed the Department of Justice to take over and continue the search efforts. A grid pattern search of the area covering a 5-mile radius around the house was conducted with canine units, but nothing was ever found. An investigation into the murders began, headed by Sheriff Thomas. Approximately 4,000 hours was dedicated to working on the case, even ruling out serial killers Henry Lee Lucas and Otis Toole as potential suspects. But they did have two possible leads, Justin's stepfather and the Sharps' neighbor, Martin Smart, and his fairly recent house guest, an ex-con named John Bo Bobaday, who was from Chicago and was rumored to have connections to the Chicago mob. When these men became persons of interest, Sheriff Thomas immediately contacted the Department of Justice in Sacramento to assist with the case. The Department of Justice then sent two men, Special Agents Harry Bradley and P.A. Krim, from their organized crime unit, not from the homicide unit, to investigate the murders. It was assumed that the only reason these special agents were sent was because of the background of John Bobaday and his connections to the Chicago mob. But Martin wasn't considered a person of interest until he claimed to investigators that a claw hammer had gone missing from his home. This was a strange comment to make, since police hadn't released any information about the weapons found at the crime scene. He also provided endless clues in the case that seemed to throw the suspicion away from him. Allegedly, Martin Smart and his wife Marilyn's marriage was falling apart. Martin was known to have cheated on his wife, and he was also abusive, had violent outbursts, and sold drugs. He had worked previously as a cook for the Keddie Lodge, but was fired several weeks before the murders. Sue, Martin, and Marilyn had all been taking business courses at the same college, and Sue had apparently been talking to Marilyn about leaving her abusive husband. Martin told authorities his whereabouts the night of the murders. He said that he and his friend Beau and Marilyn had stopped at Sue's cabin to invite her to a local bar with them. Sue said no, so they went without her. After a while, they left and went back to the Smart's cabin, walking by cabin 28. Marilyn went to bed around 11 p.m., and the men went back to the bar to have more drinks. Martin and Beau supposedly returned home around midnight. Beau had only lived with the Smarts for about 10 days. He'd met Martin in a veterans hospital while Martin was receiving treatment for PTSD. The Smarts agreed to let Beau stay with them until he got back on his feet. Someone, no one knows who, allegedly tipped off the two men that they were possible suspects. And both men very quickly left town to find work outside of California. Beau was thought to have gone back to Chicago, and Martin started working a job in Nevada. In 2008, a documentary was done on the murders, and Marilyn Smart claimed in the doc that she left her husband the day of the murders. She suspected Martin and his friend Beau were responsible for the murders. She said that on the evening of April 11, 1981, after she left Martin and Beau at the bar and returned home to go to sleep, she was woken up around 2 a.m. to find the two men burning something in their wood stove. She mentioned that Martin hated Johnny Sharp with a passion. The documentary also interviewed Sheriff Thomas, and he confirmed he'd personally interviewed Martin and that he had passed a polygraph exam. While Martin was in Nevada working, he sent a letter to Marilyn, which she would later hand over to police. The letter said that he'd been thinking about the recent struggles in their marriage and wrote,
"I've paid the price of your love, and now I've bought it with four people's lives."
In a 2016 interview, Plumas County Special Investigator Mike Gamberg admitted that the letter wasn't treated as a confession and was overlooked during the investigation and was never admitted as evidence. He went on to later criticize the quality of the initial investigation, saying that you could take someone just coming out of the academy and they'd have done a better job. On April 22, 1984, 3 years and 11 days after the murders, a bottle collector searching in the area of Camp 18 near Feather Falls in Butte County, about 30 miles from Keddie, came upon the cranium portion of a human skull and part of a mandible. A short time after the discovery of the skull was announced in the media by the Sheriff's Department, the Butte County Sheriff's Office received an anonymous 911 call that identified the remains as belonging to Tina. The audio is hard to decipher, but the caller had asked the operator, "I was wondering if they thought of the murder up in Keddy, up in Plumas County a couple years ago, where a 12-year-old girl was never found." But that call was never documented in the case file. A recording of it was found at the bottom of a sealed evidence box and remained untouched and not reviewed until sometime after 2013, when the case was reopened with new investigators and the box was opened by a deputy who was assigned to the case. In June 1984, a forensic pathologist confirmed the remains to be those of Tina Sharp. In the vicinity of the remains, detectives also found a blue nylon jacket, a child's blanket, a pair of Levi Strauss jeans with a missing back pocket, and an empty medical tape dispenser. Here's Jackie Hulbert once again, Sue's sister, speaking about Tina.
Tina was a good little girl. My heart went out with her. She was a sweet little girl. Everybody said she was a hyperactive child and she was on medication. And I just took her under my roof when she came here and I said, no, that wasn't right. She wasn't. She would sit for hours and just, you know, read a book or something like that. She was not a hyperactive kid. We got her off her medication and she was, you know, a happy little girl.
In 2016, Martin Smart's therapist alleged that he'd admitted to the murders of Sue and Tina back in 1981, but claimed that he didn't have anything to do with the boys. He said Tina was killed to prevent her from identifying him, as she had witnessed the whole thing. The conversation was told to the Department of Justice, but they dismissed the confession as hearsay. In June 2000, Martin Smart died of cancer in Portland, Oregon, and John Bobaday died in Chicago in 1988. Neither were ever named as suspects. Sheila Sharp spoke to the media in 2016 and stated that, quote, "I was told the suspects were told to get out of town by Sheriff Thomas, so to me, that means it was covered up." On March 24, 2016, a hammer that matched the description of the hammer Martin claimed to have lost was discovered in a dried-up pond just down the road from where cabin number 28 stood and taken into evidence by investigator Mike Gamberg.
And they found even more evidence years later. Right here in this pond, just down the road from where cabin 28 once stood, they found a murder weapon, this hammer, inside the pond. Surely this was a break in the case.
It's my belief that after the homicide that they were trying to get rid of the evidence. As they passed by the pond, they tossed it in.
The hammer was so rusted, no DNA could be pulled from it. But it matched the exact hammer that was reported missing from one of the suspects, Martin Smart. Investigators believe Smart and his friend John Bobaday are the main suspects.
The hammer was laying, and you can tell that it was somewhere wet. Yeah, this is the front porch.
Special investigator Mike Gamberg took us back to where that hammer was found, near the crime scene. A stone's throw away from this cabin, where investigators strongly believe the suspected killers were staying at the time of the murders.
The alleged killers who lived here, did they have any problems with law enforcement prior?
Yeah, both of them had records.
But both Marty Smart and Bo Bobaday are now dead.
Following the murders, people began staying away from the resort for obvious reasons, and within a year, it was empty. The owners put the property for sale in 1984 for $1.8 million, but it didn't sell. Over the next decade, the buildings rotted and became temporary houses for squatters and hobos and were vandalized by kids. And by that time, the county condemned most of the buildings. The owner of the resort attempted to restore some of the buildings and got it in fairly good shape and was able to rent out a couple of the best cabins. Because of the intense stigma surrounding the crime, in 2004, cabin number 28 was condemned and demolished. However, all of the evidence within the cabin is stored at the Plumas County Sheriff's Office. In April 2018, Gamberg stated that new DNA evidence had been recovered from a piece of tape at the crime scene and matched that of a known living suspect. Gamberg also stated at least six potential suspects were being examined, and they're almost certain that two accessories after the fact are still alive and claim that they're very close to solving the case.
I believe that some way, shape, or form, we're going to be able to pull this together.
It would lift an incredible weight that have just hung over that community, over the surviving family members.
As none of the victims had any enemies or had prior altercations with anyone, there are many theories as to the motive of the murders. The possibility that Martin was angry about Sue trying to convince his wife to leave him enraged Martin, and he enlisted his friend John, who was known to be a mob enforcer, to help him get rid of Sue. Another belief is that Sue and Martin were having an affair. This would explain why Marilyn left the day of the murders and why her son and the two other boys' lives were spared, and of course explains the letter from Martin to his wife. Yet another theory points to the Department of Justice and the Plumas Sheriff's Office covering up the crime due to a larger drug smuggling scheme that involved the feds. Martin was known as a drug dealer, and Beau, with his connection to the mob, may have had a financial interest in the drug distribution. This theory might also explain why the Department of Justice sent two organized crime special agents to investigate the case instead of homicide detectives. It can also explain why Martin and Beau were supposedly told by someone, allegedly Sheriff Thomas, according to Sheila, to leave town, and why the case was handled so poorly. But all of that is speculation and theories. I wish there was some definitive answers to this case. Four people's lives were lost, and their families may never know the real reason why. In May 2021, ABC News 10 posted an update on the case, stating that Detective Mike Gamberg and former Plumas County Sheriff Greg Hagwood said that critical mistakes were made 40 years ago. Evidence wasn't logged, the crime scene was tampered with, and follow-ups never happened. This case appeared to be riddled with questions and flubs and poor investigative work. Why toss a hammer, allegedly one of the murder weapons, into a nearby pond, only to leave the other weapons at the crime scene? How did only one neighbor hear muffled screams in such a vicious attack on three people? With so much evidence at the scene, the fingerprints, the blood, the 911 call, the letter of admission to Marilyn Smart, how can this case remain unsolved for so many years? After the murders, Sheila, Greg, and Rick were sent out of state to live with an aunt. Unfortunately, that wouldn't be a permanent situation, as their aunt already had several children of her own and couldn't take on any more. The children were then placed in foster care together, then were separated. In 2012, Sheila wrote a book called How to Survive Your Visit to Earth. She described it as more or less a self-help book and how she dealt with issues that have happened in her life. But it also described the murders and Sheila's theory that they were carried out by their neighbor Martin Smart and his friend Beau due to Sue counseling Marilyn about leaving Martin. The town of Keddie never really recovered from the murders. The residents no longer felt safe and started locking their doors at night. There are rumors that someone in town knew who committed the murders. And there was also the belief that the Plumas County Sheriff's Office did a shoddy job on the case. They didn't follow up on leads, didn't check for additional evidence, and ignored some evidence completely. There is still a $5,000 reward for any information that leads to an arrest and prosecution in the case. That does it for this episode of The Crime Shack. Thank you for listening. Please check out our website at thecrimeshack.com, where you can find links to all our social media platforms. If you have any feedback or suggestions for future episodes, please reach out to us and be sure to go on Apple Podcasts or your favorite podcast platform and leave us a review. We love to hear from our listeners. Until next time, stay safe out there.